From Capital Public Radio, this is The View from Here. I'm Catherine Stifter, producer of The View from Here. Welcome to the very first episode of our new podcast, Place and Privilege. The members of our documentary team have been in the field for nearly a year, gathering stories, researching, and reporting on Sacramento's housing affordability crisis. It's a tough issue everywhere, not only in California's capital, but the whole state and the rest of the country, too. I asked Beth Ruyak, host of Cap Radio's daily talk show, Insight, to help us launch the project with an interview about what we've learned. This is Episode 1. What does privilege have to do with it?
A team of reporters has been digging into affordable housing. And if you're paying attention to the news on this topic, you know that those two words, affordable housing, are usually followed by the word crisis, affordable housing crisis. And what exactly does that mean? And how did it get to be this way? In this 8-part podcast series, we're going to hear some answers to those two questions and some ideas for what to do next, how to get out of the crisis. And following the podcast series, there will be an hour-long documentary. That was the original goal of the reporters' work. So let's cue them. Here they are, the reporters. Hi, everybody.
Hello.
Hello.
Amy Quinton is Cap Radio's environment reporter. This is a little bit off your beat.
A little bit,
maybe
yeah.
In your beat. Pauline Bartoloni is a reporter with Kaiser Health News, an interesting angle on this subject. Hi, Pauline.
Hi, Beth.
Amy Westervelt is a freelance reporter and author from Truckee, which has its own spin on the crisis. Hi, Amy.
Hi, Beth.
And Cosmo Garvin returns to The View from Here for your third project now.
I think that's right. Third project.
So I didn't expect that you would be covering the same causes or finding the same conclusions about affordable housing. And you didn't, did you? Have you had a chance to talk amongst yourselves about all of this?
We've had lots of meetings.
Because you've spent many months looking at the history, the politics, the economics of housing affordability. Cosmo, will you start with the title of this whole project, Place and Privilege? What does that mean to you?
So to me, place and privilege, you know, based on a lot of the reporting I've been doing for this project, really evokes the idea that we have all kinds of housing policies and land use policies that, it turns out, really advantage some people, some groups of people, and exclude other people. And I've been kind of digging into the history of housing segregation in the region. That's part of the reporting I've been doing. So going back to, you know, the early 20th century and some of the really racist racial covenants that were in place in Sacramento and the later redlining policies, you know, those old policies that really sort of established patterns of segregation that really persist today and in some ways, unfortunately, are reinforced by policies that we have in place even today.
Yeah, and I think if I could just cut in here, I think also where you live now also determines how privileged you are and how much access you have to resources. And I know Pauline's story touches on that a lot.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my story is about how hospitals are really stepping up in the fight to end homelessness here. And hospitals in Sacramento and elsewhere are realizing that where you live and how you live really determines your health. So with homeless people, if you're living on the street, if you're not having a good night's sleep, if you're not eating well, you're going to show up more in emergency rooms and it's going to be harder for you to stay healthy.
Where you live is certainly an aspect for Amy Westervelt in her story, her work.
Yeah, I was just listening to everyone talk and thinking that in Tahoe, it's sort of just super obvious because you have people who are visiting or who own second homes that are millionaires and billionaires. And then you have the people who serve them who are kind of hidden one street over, you know. So really, like, specifically where you live is a big part of your identity. Even in where I live in Truckee, it's, you know, people will ask, what subdivision do you live in? And if you're Martis Camp, that means you're very wealthy. And if you're, you know, if you live in Kings Beach, that means something else. So, yeah, it's interesting.
Okay, group yes or no questions here. Is there one single cause for how we got here? Yes or no?
No.
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 Okay. Is what that cause is even clear? Yes or no?
Sometimes.
I don't think so.
There are many causes.
Everybody has a different take on it, depending on what their lens or their frame of reference. That's what I gather.
I think that's also why there's not one solution to it. Right. There's many different causes, and there's not going to be one silver bullet to address all the issues.
And there's so many different stakeholders. You know, you've got developers who want one thing. You've got young people who want one thing. Older people who want something else. Families want something. Single working people need something else. So, you know.
We spent a moment on place and privilege, but let's back up to affordable housing crisis or affordable housing. Just looking at that, there are some things we can agree on. It is a problem across a broad socioeconomic level. Cosmo?
I think that is true, that it is across a broad, you know, many people are affected by it at many different income levels. However, the market is still providing housing for, you know, some people with means and not for a lot of other folks.
But it might be a perception for a low-income community that this is going to be a problem, and that's not always the case, is it, Pauline?
That it's a problem for one particular community and not another. I mean, I focused mainly on homelessness, but and there are many causes of homelessness. And one thing I learned through my main character, Tony Price, is that it's incredible how easy it is to fall into homelessness and how hard it is to crawl your way out of it. So I imagine it's the same for anybody struggling to find affordable housing. Anybody could have a problem finding affordable housing for a variety of reasons.
You know, and they, I say they, government officials by definition say if you're spending 30% or more of your income on housing, you are by definition rent overburdened. But what we're finding is that basically means half of Sacramento is rent overburdened. And so if you're paying more than 30%, you're really struggling.
In Tahoe, it's more like 80% of people are paying much more than that.
Pauline, you actually gave a nice setup for us to go into Amy Quinton's story because, Amy, you looked at renters in sort of middle income bracket and gave such a vivid description of how a shift in just a couple circumstances can make all the difference. So let's start with Amber Calloway. And this goes back to the heavy rains in December.
That's right. She's just below middle income. But yeah, all of her problems with her housing started back in December when we had those first heavy rains. They did some damage to the walls in her. She lives in a three-bedroom home, and they started really destroying some of the walls. They needed major repairs. And so she complained to her property manager about the issue. And 3 days after she complained, she got a notice that she should vacate the premises, which is a it's not an eviction notice, but it's like you have 60 days to leave. And we have a cut of hers about that.
I was basically emotional, angry, scared, sad, all at the same time, to where I just, you know, wanted to just start crying. And so I was crying on the phone to her, you know, begging her to give me another month, you know. And I was like, you just gonna put me and my son out on the street if I can't find a place? You know, what if I don't find a place in 2 months? What happens then?
So she found a termination of tenancy notice in her mailbox. She had 60 days to get out. And this actually leads us to something that is true in Sacramento County, not necessarily everywhere. But Cosmo, I want to bring you in because under the current rules, a property owner just has free license to raise rent or evict at any point in time?
I think there are some notice requirements.
If there's no lease, I should say. If there's no lease.
That's correct. And then also there are notice requirements. If there's no lease, then they can raise rent with a certain amount of notice. And I think if it's above a certain percentage, I think, Amy, you probably know these numbers.
Yeah, if it's you get a 30-day notice. If it's, I think, under 10% of an increase, and you get a 60-day notice if it's more than that. But if you're month to month, you don't have a lot of rights to, you know, prevent a rent from increasing.
And this isn't a new policy in Sacramento. It's been around for a long time, hasn't it?
That's right.
Cosmo, add some perspective here, because some of the policies that are in place have clearly contributed to the division of the city, to the segregating of communities. And I don't know how far back these policies go, but there must have been a point in time when a lot of these decisions were being made.
There have been so many decisions that have been made over the decades, and I think it's really important to remember that they were decisions, that things didn't get to be the way they are by accident. These were conscious policy decisions that were made over the years.
By people who had power, like developers or politicians in districts?
By developers, by banks, by people, you know, through the policies that they support. And so, again, that goes all the way back to, you know, done a lot of reporting exploring sort of the racist. There's really no other word for it.
Why are you hesitant to say that?
You know, that's because it's a very charged word to say that, you know, policies are racist or were racist.
So are you getting caught up in whether there was intention there to be racist or whether it just became that way?
I think if you look back at, you know, racial covenants and you know, it's clearly there was racist intent there to exclude different people. When you get into, you know, I talked to the author Richard Rothstein about the racism embedded in some of the New Deal housing policies. And that's a little more surprising, to think of the New Deal in some ways as being racist or promoting racial exclusion. And yet, you know, that was the effect of many of these policies. So those decisions did shape cities all across the country, including Sacramento. In some ways, we are less segregated than other cities, and we like to think of ourselves as being this very diverse city, and we are a very diverse city and in many ways more integrated than other communities. Somewhat by accident, in some cases, but there still are obviously, you know, neighborhoods that are where there are racially concentrated areas of poverty, and there are other policies that that aren't helping to untangle those patterns that, you know, may be reinforcing them.
I want to hear a little bit of the conversation you had with Bill Kennedy. He's a former attorney for Legal Services of Northern California. And I don't know if we need to set this up so specifically. We'll just hear more about it after he makes his comments. So here's Bill Kennedy.
When we look at the land that is available for development in the county, and we say 100% of it goes to market rate developers, we are saying we are only going to build something for the top 30% of the socioeconomic strata, and everyone else can deal with the crumbs that follow, that trickle down. We have a policy that recognizes that those who can make a lot of money out of development and those who can afford to buy, as long as that can happen, everyone else be damned. And you can only support that rationally and feel good about that if you have this sense that, well, there are deserving people and there are undeserving people. Well, a majority of the people in Sacramento County are not undeserving. They're deserving of houses. They're deserving of homes. They're deserving of warmth. They're deserving of protection. They deserve to live in an area where the benefits of the economy reach them. This is where race and ethnicity come in again. Power and wealth are intergenerational. You can't expect in a generation to create the wealth that is going to allow you to move forward with opportunity. The civil rights movement opened up some doors, but our land use policies closed those doors.
to hear Bill Kennedy talk about it, the bias is perpetuated. It just might come under a different umbrella.
I think that's right. I think that's, you know, sort of what I drew from that part of our conversation. And I liked that clip because it really does in some ways sort of get at the whole sweep of policy choices that we've made over the years and how it really can sort of feed back on itself.
If we continue talking about policy, there's a place where we don't feel the issue so closely. We don't get kind of person to person to it. So, Amy, let's go back to your story. The other character in your story is Gracie Phillips, and she owned her own home in North Highlands. She was doing what you try to do as, an American and a parent and a graduate, college graduate. And then what happened?
Right. Well, I mean, it's unfortunate because Gracie in many ways is a statistic. She, before the recession, owned her own home. She had a good job, but then things started to fall apart. She lost her job. She got a divorce. She had to put up her home for a short sale. So she ruined her credit. She went back to school. She got, you know, inundated with student loan debt for a master's degree, thinking that she'd advance her career. It still took her a very long time to find a job. So she ended up in Oak Park and living in a home that with her son that is just, you know, it's not a good home. It's not, as she says, it looks like an okay house, and it does. It looks like an okay house, but she has a lot of problems with it. And what Gracie wants more than anything is to own her own home again. And I say she represents a statistic because during the recession, Black homeownership was much higher than it is now. After the recession, African Americans are being hurt way more than they were before. And so she is one of the statistics that says, you know, African Americans are not having homeownership like they used to. Mm. In fact, here she is. She's talking about how she went to a loan originator to own a home, to talk about owning a home anyway, and was told she could only afford something for $165,000, which in Sacramento, the average or the median sales price right now is $330,000. So she's talking about living on the edge.
You know, I feel impoverished. You know what I mean? I feel almost destitute. I feel like living in my car would almost be okay because then I could really bank my money and buy a house. You know what I'm saying? No PG&E, no SMUD. We could park in front of the school, you know? Wouldn't have to worry about a bus or anything. There's a whole list of things that I could do if I lived in my car.
The definition of home really changes for people, doesn't it? It certainly sounds like it did for Gracie and for Amber.
Yeah, it's just unfathomable that somebody could think, well, if I live in my car, maybe I can someday own a home. I mean, that's a lot of people are living in that situation right now where they want to own a home so bad, and home ownership is just, they're not going to get there.
Amy, up in Tahoe, tell me what the picture is like in light of this conversation we're having about race and finances and the neighborhood.
I think a lot of people don't realize that Tahoe has one of the highest poverty rates in the state, not just the region. Kings Beach is a California poverty pocket. There are 31% of families are living in poverty, according to federal guidelines for that, which is about $24,000 a year for a family of four. It also has the highest employment rate. So it's this really weird combination of people who are just working like crazy and can't get ahead. And most of those people tend to be Mexican immigrants, at least in Kings Beach and in parts of South Lake Tahoe, although there are definitely pockets of, you know, white working class people that are in similar straits. But I was thinking when Amy was talking, like when I was interviewing Amy Kelly from the North Tahoe Family Resource Center, she was talking about the people that she works with. And one of the things she said was, can you imagine if, you know, you lost just one of the things that you rely on, like health insurance or your car. And I was like, yeah, I can't imagine, because I just lost health insurance. You know, I might have to lose my car because it's expensive here. You know, like it's not just I think people tend to think of it as like, oh, it's these poor people over here. You know, like I have a degree and I have a professional job. This would never happen to me. But, you know, it happens.
And I think that actually points out another thing that we're not talking about a lot, which is rents are increasing, housing costs are increasing, but our wages are not increasing.
Yeah.
And that's something I know a lot of people struggle with. And the statistics bear it out that the wages just, you know, they're increasing quite a bit, but there's still a huge gap.
And it's been stagnant for a long period of time. Sometimes people build their lives with a certain amount of buffer for emergency. And maybe an emergency could be considered 2 or 3 years as a long-term emergency. But we're now 10 years, at least 8 to 10 years into a downturn that has been enough to prompt a real shift. So suddenly all these things that, as you're talking about, Cosmo, all these policies that have been in place become a real life shift for people. Amy, when people...
I got so upset. I'm sorry.
Oh.
Listening to that lady, I was like, I've had that thought. Like, I've totally been like, oh, I could live in my 4Runner. You know, like, I could... It's big enough that we could, like, camp out all summer, you know, and, like, pretend that everything's fine.
Well, yeah. I mean, I've already cried, so no worries there. I mean, these are just really compelling stories, and they hit home, and they should hit home for people. We're not talking about, you know, people that are of very low income. We are talking about them, but this is hitting people of all classes.
So... can I scratch your surface a little more? Why is this hitting real deeply for you too, Amy?
The same reason it's hitting for Amy is that it's just hitting people that are of median income or maybe even more, that you do everything that you're supposed to do.
Yeah.
You go to college, you get a good degree, you get a good paying job. But then in California, you just can't afford a home. You can't afford a place to live. And that's a tragedy for this state. I mean, everybody wants to live in California. Well, we don't have enough housing to make that happen.
And it just takes one thing, you know, like you have, in my case, you know, we had family members that, you know, had illnesses that we had to, you know, deal with paying for. My husband's from a different country and he had to like make an emergency trip home that was an unexpected expense. It just takes a few of these things that come up for everyone, and all of a sudden you're like very seriously considering living in your car, you know, which is it. And I was just thinking the same thing when you were talking, that like you do all the things that they say are what you're supposed to do to get this American dream, and it's not there at the end of it, you know, and you have this chronic instability that is super stressful. And like you were talking about health impacts too, I think people are very unstable, and a lot of people, like a large percentage of the population, are in that.
I know, you know, and just listening to Gracie talk, I mean, I was just like, I want to buy this woman a home. I want to buy her a home. I don't have a home, so I can't buy her a home, but I want to buy her a home. And I, you know, she did so much to try to get a home. Even after she lost a job, she went to Habitat for Humanity. She's like, they build homes for families. Maybe me and my son can get a home if I go to Habitat for Humanity, but they only work with families that have 2 children. That would be the qualification for her to get a home based on her income level. If she had had one more person in a household, she could have gotten a Habitat for Humanity home. And it's just like, you know, these are just the stories we hear.
I just wanted to amplify the theme of health that I think underlies all of our stories. You know, we've been talking about how where you live determines your health, but I think it could be the flip side too, that it can just take one health crisis to cause somebody to lose their house or be homeless. And that's what happened with Tony Price. He was working in Silicon Valley in the tech sector, and he said his anxiety got out of control. He couldn't go to work anymore and lost his job. And then next thing he knows, he's homeless for 5 years. So it really can happen to anyone.
The stress level of some of our subjects can make you sick. When you're constantly worrying about how you're going to feed your family or how you're going to pay your rent, it makes you sick. Gracie was telling me she's stressed all the time. It makes her fibromyalgia worse. It makes her asthma worse. And then she's got to pay more for her prescriptions. And it just goes on
and on. Which means that each of those people is more plugged in and more in need in the health system than we should be, we need to be, or that she would be otherwise. You're listening to Place and Privilege. It is a Capital Public Radio podcast from The View From Here. I've been talking with reporters Amy Quinton, Cosmo Garvin, Pauline Bartolone, and Amy Westervelt. They've each been exploring the housing affordability problems in the region. They're doing it not only for this podcast series, but for an upcoming documentary. In fact, I think you all learned so much in your work toward the documentary that it was just natural that there needed to be another landing place. So this is it, the podcast series. Is that right? That says to me that you each maybe had some surprises along the way. Cosmo, what surprised you in, and we didn't really even talk yet about the fact that you really spent time with Linda Brooks, who's 71, mm-hmm. and dealing with displacement. But what was surprising?
Yeah, Linda, one of the stories I did was Linda, who has lived in the same place for 20-something years, has used a housing choice voucher, what most folks still think of as a Section 8 voucher. Mm. And her landlord decided, you know what, the market is such as it is. We don't need to take vouchers anymore. You know, please move on. And so it was surprising to learn how sort of easy it is to lose your home because you are on a voucher and how hard it is. She doesn't drive. You know, we went all around town looking for apartments that would take a voucher. She's not in great health. You know, we're riding buses and stuff. That's what she has to do to try to find a place to live. And it's really hard out there to find a place that will take voucher tenants. And it's not – the places are not in the neighborhoods where she's going to have access to transit and be able to get to her doctor's offices.
Was there also age discrimination in her search, at least subtly?
I don't know if there's evidence of that. And, in fact, one place that she was going to – be able to get into was a senior apartment complex, which she didn't want to live in. She was, you know, I'm not ready for that. I want to live around people with different ages, you know, and so I think, I mean, I don't know if this is surprising to me, but it really brought home to me how the rules are different when you can't afford, you know, a decent housing, how what it's like to be behind sort of the eight ball. It's very precarious.
That story, too, Pauline, connected directly to health care. And as you do age, you want to be able to get to your appointments. You want to be able to know that you're reliable as a patient so that you can be seen when you need to or if you need treatments. That's part of the puzzle of mm-hmm. putting together where you live.
That's right. I mean, one of the things that was surprising to me is just how housing is really a life or death situation for some people. I talked to four different formerly homeless people, and they each said, without me asking them, that they would be dead without the housing that they have right now, the housing that they got through the help of some of the hospital programs to get folks out of the emergency rooms. And that was really powerful for me to hear. This one man, he's very heavy. He has respiratory problems, and he said, being homeless means that he would have to walk, you know, walking a half a mile or a mile in the heat would literally kill him, could kill him, send him to the emergency room. And so having a place to nap or rest or, you know, to have a good night's sleep, it's literally life-saving for him.
We have some of your conversation with Tony Price. You mentioned Tony earlier. So he's speaking to exactly what you're discussing. Let's listen to Tony.
If I wouldn't have got housing, if I would have still been on the streets, I definitely would have been dead by now. When I got in here, if I wouldn't have stopped drinking, I probably would have been dead by now. But it afforded me the chance to see a little clearer. It's like, okay, you know, are you going to screw this up like everything else? Are you going to get kicked out of this great opportunity? You know, you have a home again. That was what the first thoughts were on, you know, exploring getting the medication. And then once I got the medication and my doctor was behind me 100%, everything changed.
I don't know how you convince someone to not give up, but in the characters in your stories, I do hear resiliency and a willingness to keep going, you know, aiming for Amber and Gracie not to be so frustrated that they give up, but they have children. So that is a huge incentive. Tony sounds like just really wanted to turn his life around.
Yeah. And, you know, we've been talking a lot about a spiral. One thing happens and then it sends you into possible homelessness. Tony just described how it kind of happened the other way around. He landed into the hospital after a suicide attempt and they hooked him up with some temporary housing. Then from there, he started seeing doctors regularly. He got on medication to get him to quit drinking. And it kind of gave him the agency and the hope to be a functional person again.
I think that the word developer has been mentioned once or twice. We haven't spent much time there. And there are a lot of viewpoints that point to the developers often being bad guys or at least abusing the system. A Frontline report recently did some finger pointing at men and women on the developer side who have abused the system. What did you hear from people you spoke to about the developer role in why we've gotten to this crisis point, Cosmo?
So I would think specifically I looked at some policies that the city and county both tried for a number of years, which required developers to build affordable housing in with their larger developments. And those rules didn't last very long. Developers and builders didn't like them to begin with. And then the recession came. And then when redevelopment went away, a lot of the money to build those affordable units went away. And that was a real – it was a political conflict that went on for a while. And I think a lot of people did see developers as the bad guy in that fight. However, you know, we have to remember that we were asking developers to solve this problem, to you know, cut into their profits to solve this problem, which is really a larger social problem. And so in some ways, those policies were trying to, the argument is, sort of put that responsibility onto developers when it wasn't fair to. And so this, it's very complicated to sort of untangle this stuff sometimes and figure out where the money's going to come from.
And you raise an interesting issue, and that is, where's the incentive to jump in and provide a solution? Which, Pauline, makes your story so interesting. Who would think that a nonprofit healthcare organization would have incentive to become involved in the affordable housing issue? But at least one does. Mm-hmm. Will you explain?
Yeah, I'm worried that we're depressing people here, talking a lot about the problems. And they're actually, part of our documentary is there are some solutions in terms of new money being given to the campaign to end homelessness, at least in Sacramento. And hospitals, I found, are really recognizing the need to house people in order to promote health. And this helps people get the right care at the right time in the right setting, in their words. So Dignity Health has invested in some temporary housing programs. Sutter Health is making an enormous investment to end homelessness. It's called the Getting to Zero campaign.
That's the one I was thinking of, because I think it sets such a statement not only across the state, but really across the country about a willingness to be very community invested.
Mm-hmm. And Sutter's campaign is, you know, one of a few that we've seen recently nationwide. There was a hospital system in Oregon and Florida that invested millions of dollars into new housing for homeless folks to keep people out of the emergency room and promote their health.
Let's go back to Tony Price, who was formerly homeless. How is this program, or how did the program work for him?
So Tony got hooked up through the Housing with Dignity program when he landed in Dignity Hospital. And they hooked him up with 4 months of temporary housing with a caseworker to take him to medical appointments, make sure that he's getting hooked up to benefits so he can get a monthly income. And the whole reason why the hospitals are doing it is because they're seeing a lot of homeless people just come repeatedly into their emergency departments. They're giving them episodic care, but they're not getting well because the underlying causes of their poor health are not being addressed. So this is Dignity Health, Sutter Health, hospitals across the country are seeing that investing in housing can help get people the right care at the right time.
That's Pauline Bartolone. Let's listen to a little bit of your conversation with Tony. I think you asked him whether he feels guilty for using hospital services as a place to sleep.
There are people in there with real emergencies. And here's this drunk guy just taking him a bed. You know, like I was saying, at the time, I basically didn't give a but somewhere in the back of my mind, you know, it's just not survival mode or, you know, being greedy or thinking myself. Somewhere in the back, you know, there's still the, you know, civilized, you know, person basically going, this is wrong. You know, what if there's somebody out in the hallway right now who's having an issue who dies out there because you're in a bed?
And just to give more context about that, he had said that he felt ashamed that he was using the emergency department so much for basically to sleep off a hard day's drinking. But the way homeless folks have described it to me is that you're in survival mode when you're on the streets. You're just thinking about how to get food and sleep and stay warm and be safe. And so if that means going to the emergency department to find that, that's what they do.
There are different front lines of this battle. There's that front line, especially vivid in Sacramento, of dealing with homelessness. And Amy, as you're describing, looking at the scope of the problem and the movement of classes of people in the Tahoe area, many housing experts have said to me it's really about law and policy. And both at the city, county levels of government, and certainly the state of California, there's a push to shift some laws. Amy, for example, in Amber's case or Gracie's case, are they paying attention to the bigger picture of this problem?
I think they don't like to think of themselves as part of this big system, but they are. Amber said to me that she doesn't feel like a victim. Of course, she's not a victim. She's going to power through, and this is all going to be okay. Gracie sees a little bit of that because she lives in Oak Park, where she's seeing homes flip and families being displaced. And I've looked at some of the statistics. The flip rate in Oak Park is nearing 20%, which is a large amount. And she's like, and where are these families going? Where are they going? I have no idea. And she actually even talks about the homes that have been flipped, the gates that are typically in the front yards in Oak Park are coming down, and white picket fences are going up, and she's calling them gentrification fences. So she definitely sees herself as part of this larger system that's affecting how policies are affecting her and her neighborhood.
How much did you look at that on the state level? So many bills were proposed this year. Some were proposed 2 years ago. They didn't get much traction, but there's a different awareness now in 2017.
Yeah, and we're still waiting for housing deals, right? Or still the session is sort of careening to an end here.
Do you see more weight, Cosmo, on law and policy in the influence of solutions here?
I think there are a lot of policy discussions that are happening right now, at the local level, and a lot more discussions that need to happen. And there are no end of ideas out there. I mean, you've got groups out there that are trying to push you know, rent control ordinances, and you've got, you know, Mayor Steinberg has come in and has committed to getting, you know, 2,000 people off the streets, and that's going to be a set of policies that are really focused on these chronically homeless folks, you know, folks who really need intensive services. And then, but that doesn't include folks like Linda, who I talked to, who wrote to the mayor asking for some sort of insight into her situation and pushing for policies that would prevent people from like her from being evicted. And that's not anywhere on the policy agenda right now. So there are many different avenues that people are trying to push policy solutions in right now.
And there's no one building homes for median income families right now. Right. It just doesn't pencil out. And that's one of the podcasts that I'm doing, talking to many developers about, well, why is this? Why aren't you doing more to include, you know, median income? Why is it not penciling out? And that's something more that we'll hear. Nikki Mohanna is one of the developers I talk to, and a lot of people know her because she's doing a development on 19th and J Street, the micro units. She's a millennial. She saw that there was a need in the marketplace. They can't afford homes right now. And the only way she could get it to pencil out is to build these very tiny little units. That doesn't help families. No family is going to live in a 400 square foot apartment, but it does help millennials. But she also said it barely penciled out for her. And, you know, she did it out of the kindness of her heart. And she said, well, maybe other developers should do that, too. Well, that's like saying, well, why don't you do your job, but don't get a paycheck? It's really, I mean, it's just there's so much that's between a rock and a hard place. And like I said, it, you know, finding the solution is going to take a lot of different avenues.
That's Amy Quinton. I'm also talking with Cosmo Garvin, Pauline Bartolone, and Amy Westervelt. These reporters are talking about their work on the affordable housing crisis. It's part of a bigger project from CAP Radio's documentary team, The View From Here. The project is called Place and Privilege. The hour-long documentary will be broadcast on Capital Public Radio on October 6th, and then that documentary becomes a podcast episode when it airs. Well, thank you to all of you for the work that everybody's about to see and for the conversation about it as we set the stage for this whole project. It's been a big one. I know it's taken a lot of commitment, but there'll be so much coming out online. My thanks to you for beginning the podcast.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Beth.
Thank you, Beth.
Thank you. The View From Here, Place and Privilege will explore the history, the politics, the economics, and as you heard, the real personal side of housing affordability in California's capital. Also, there's an effort to map the crisis through these stories, through the people who have been hardest hit and living on the edge. And in conjunction with the project, there will be a number of live community storytelling events. And if you go to theviewfromhere.org, you can find not only links to these podcast episodes, but a registration for those live events. I'm Beth Ruiak. Thanks for joining us on Capital Public Radio for this first in the View From Here podcast series, Place and Privilege.
Next on episode 2, Segregated Sacramento.
So basically what you have is an X, a east to west pattern of public investment and a north-south pattern of disinvestment. By this racial geography, you can measure every social ill in our city today. Poverty, crime, educational attainment, employment, healthcare. Think of any social good that you can measure, and you can measure it by this north-south geography in our county.
You've been listening to the View From Here podcast, Place and Privilege, Episode 1, What Does Privilege Have to Do With It? Thanks to Beth Ruiak, host of Insight. This episode was produced by Chris Remington, edited by Sally Schilling, music by Privileges. As Beth mentioned, you can find everything about this project at our website, theviewfromhere.org, including information about our live community storytelling events this fall. You can get the Place and Privilege podcast on Apple, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get podcasts. Follow us on social media with the hashtag #ViewOnHousing. This is The View From Here from Capital Public Radio. I'm Catherine Stifter. Thanks for listening.